Hi, everyone. Welcome to episode 33 of the Upward Spiral podcast, presented by Hypebot.com. Today on the podcast, we're talking to JJ Italiano, a manager, producer, and major label veteran, man who wears many hats. JJ got his start in Denver managing the Flowbots, who rose to alt stardom with Handlebars, and then signed a major label deal. After parting ways with them, JJ managed I Fight Dragons and MC Lars, among others, and also worked at Universal on the Gautier album. He's currently living in LA, taking a break from management and working on music production. But more than any of this, JJ is one of my favorite people to talk with about the state of music and technology, and why the more things change, the more they seem to stay the same. I am Courtney Harding. I develop and manage partnerships at Sounddrop, a social music application for Spotify, web, and iOS devices.
And I'm Kyle Belin, a user researcher and technology writer at Live Nation Labs, a web and mobile product development group at the company.
As I said at the top of the show, we're joined by JJ Italiano, who has lots and lots of opinions about the music industry, to put it mildly.
Yeah, thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
All right, so let's jump in because this is going to be really super fun. My first question is a really simple one, but it kind of requires some setup. Why does the first week still matter so much? And by this I mean after all the changes, after the seismic shifts in the record industry over the past 15 years, why are most labels still obsessed with setting up a strong first week in terms of album sales, especially given the fact that album sales are an increasingly shrinking piece of the revenue pie?
I mean, I think that that's an old habit that is going to die very hard. I mean, for a very long time, that was the metric of the success of a release. That was just the way that it was. And I think it's hard for a lot of folks to rethink that paradigm. I mean, even for labels that can like look beyond the first week and realize that there's more revenue to be made over time, there's still a perception from people on the outside and people in media and in press and the people that are booking TV shows and people are booking radio shows where that still kind of weighs on them just because that was the way that it was for such a long time. And I think that, I mean, altogether, I mean, if you were to look at the big picture, I think that the challenge isn't necessarily limited to music, but this is kind of a challenge in TV, film. It's a challenge in a lot of different businesses right now because we're kind of like shifting into this long tail zeitgeist where, you know, things are different. It's not as much put it on TV and hope it sells when it comes out anymore. And I think that that's just going to be a tough transition for folks. For me personally, like I've never really had a release that was like hugely, largely anticipated in the mainstream or been working with a budget that was like able to manufacture that kind of interest. It's never really been a factor for me. If it was, I'd have been like really depressed every time the first week anything came out because it's like you almost expect to fail when you're starting from nothing. I mean, for the most part, every week matters. I feel like the first week is kind of the least important if you're on the way indie side of that. But I do think that that's kind of the way that's going.
So I guess my follow-up for that is, you know, when we talk about first week, a lot of the conversation we have is about like how well an album places on the Billboard Top 200 or, you know, whatever chart for whatever territory it's released in. And I guess, you know, my follow-up is like, why are labels so still obsessed with chart positions when in fact charts are really losing their meaning, at least for album sales? I mean, you can argue the singles charts are much more influential, but like you can be at the top of the Billboard chart and sell 30,000 records and still have a number one album, and at a certain point, it just becomes kind of irrelevant.
I mean, I think for sure. I mean, I think it's definitely less relevant now than it was before because I think, with the way that people interact with music also, like the sales aren't necessarily representative of the engagement of the fans or how many customers you have or the amount of revenue you're generating. So it's more of an outdated, you know, every week it becomes more and more outdated. But I think it's kind of a collective psychology that I don't know if is limited just to the labels anyway. I think it's a talking point and people like to have the stories like, oh, this debuted at number one, or, you know, it's a thing to talk about. And in that regard, it is meaningful. I mean, what people are thinking about and discussing is meaningful. you know, I don't know. I don't know that it's a great business metric, and I think a lot of folks aren't paying attention to it. I think a lot more people are talking about it than people are probably making informed or you know, important decisions around.
And I guess sort of the last point on this is, and I wrote release dates. Why? Like, what's the point of having a release date when, A, half the time it's going to get changed, and if you've worked in the record industry long enough, particularly on the hip-hop side or the pop side, it seems like, you know, these release dates are, like, free-floating. Like, they just sort of, like, evolve over time. And then, you know, half the time the album's just going to leak anyway. I mean, most of the time the label's going to leak it. And then it's this idea of, like, we're still putting out albums on Tuesday. And that made sense when we had physical record stores. But now we have Spotify, and now we have iTunes, and you could literally release a record anytime you want. And I understand that I understand how the chart week works, but again, it just seems like such an antiquated model, like, to have a release date. Like, why don't you just finish making a record and tell some people about it and put it out?
I mean, I think a lot of people do, and I think a lot of people will. I agree completely. Like, the idea of focusing on a particular release date arbitrarily or just solely because that's the thing to do it's not even a bad idea. It's just like not really anything. It's not going to have much effect one way or the other. I think that I can only glean from my experience in the major label system, because it's almost the same principle. It's that when you have something that's new and it's like, hey, this is coming out soon, that's more of a talking point when you're trying to get attention from media, press, or any other kind of marketing initiative that you're doing. And it's one of those things that it's not really limited specifically to the record industry as much as it is several industries that are kind of participating together in the way that we interact with music. And I think that, I mean, especially for new artists, it's absolutely irrelevant. I think that it's also, I mean, for the most part, benign. Like, you know, people can do that, whatever. It's certainly not contributing to the decline of the industry, with the exception of when, like, you know, a release date or first week is made so important on a project that it detracts from the attention you pay, you know, to what happens after that. Or if it discourages people at a label or at a management company or artists themselves, to the point where they don't really, you know, you don't do the work that you need to do. Because even more now, especially with more, you know, with Spotify and the way that we're making money over the long-term use of the music, you know, you have to be working all the time. I think it always makes sense to be marketing.
Yeah, and I guess I just wanted to do one more follow-up on this point to sort of pick apart this, like, larger idea of, you know, the music industry, how they haven't changed very much. You know, people are still releasing full albums, and I saw some Spotify data recently, which I think is public, I hope it's public, about how people consume music on Spotify in terms of listening to singles versus listening to albums, and way more people listen to just singles than listen to full albums on Spotify. So, you know, setting aside bands who make records as an artistic statement, right? So, like, Tool is not a singles band. Radiohead are not a singles band. They make these records that are meant to be listened to with full bodies of work. But most pop artists and dance artists don't do that. They just make a bunch of singles. And some of the singles are good and some of them aren't. And, you know, I'm sort of wondering, like, do we need albums from, like, EDM artists or pop artists? Like, why couldn't they just release a bunch of really great singles and not have to sort of shoehorn it into, like, a 12-track album?
I mean, I think that's probably where we're going. And it's like a lot of things. It's like we're in this, it's a transition right now. I'm sure that, and I can't speak from experience, but I'm sure that somewhere in the world there's a pop artist that is being pressured to make a full-length record by a label for purely business reasons, because you make more money on a record than a single. But I would think, I mean, you know, I feel like every year we get more and more accustomed to, you know, releasing music in all different kinds of packages. And I mean, I think EPs, I feel like, is happening all over the place right now, like, especially with new artists and the things that I'm interested in. I feel like most of the time it's an EP that crosses my desk first. And I really like that format. Like, I think it works really well. For the most part, there's going to be records, and I think, like you said, I mean, there's going to be some artists that are going to make full-length records, and that's probably not going to change either. But I don't think that we're as much like attached to these are the rules and this is the way it's going to go. I think that actually is a way that I think the music industry is starting to change, and probably inevitably, pop artists will just kind of stick with singles. For me, like if I put my like producer hat on for a second, I'd try to never be attached to the length of something that we're going to do. I think I would always, if there's five songs that the band and I and everybody decide these are the songs, I'd way rather make a 5-track EP than try to figure out a way like where we're going to put that filler in there. Cause that's an outdated way of doing it. People don't, you know, people aren't stuck with the CD and they're not going to listen to it over and over and over in their car because it's the only CD they have in their car anymore. You know, if the record's not good, it's not good, and it doesn't matter how long it is.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's interesting, the sort of idea of how we filled the sort of space and time that we were able to and packaged that and sort of sold it to the consumer. And that, well, certainly that was the status quo and it existed for some time. The reality of how the market works now, and as sort of Courtney alluded to, how they consume things, no longer aligns with that model. And it is really interesting to see, you know, Spotify in the sort of playlist taxonomy is more focused on singles, where you have a company like Ardio that is definitely more focused on albums. It's really interesting to see the sort of like generational conceptions of how music is presented and consumed and sort of organized, both shape the way that it's produced and created.
Absolutely, man. And I think that like people's listening habits and the things that you're accustomed to as a listener, they're highly individualized now. And I think hopefully will continue to be even more individualized. If you were to look at my Spotify, it's all of the playlists are albums. I like listening to albums, and it's a habit that I picked up when I was younger, and that's what you did. But I really like to hear kind of the totality of a complete piece. There are very few artists now that I think of it that way, and they want to make an album as a complete, you know, as a complete work with made up of several individual works. But some do, and I think that you know, it comes back to knowing your audience, which is going to be the most important thing, I think, moving forward for artists and managers and producers, is to be thinking about, you know, what are people going to enjoy the most, and not be too attached to the context of whatever it is, you know, how long it is.
So have you ever, you know, in terms of like trying to get to know your audience, do you ever walk through the checkout line at Target, pick up the $10 gummy earphones, go rip Miley Cyrus Wrecking Ball YouTube audio, and then play it loudly through your gummy headphones?
I have not done that yet. It sounds, I mean, I'm sure it's exactly like how I think it is.
I'd really love to switch the sort of conversation now to one of your management clients, MC Lars. Two of his well-known singles in 2006, Download This Song and I Generation, are about, you know, the new age of digital music listeners, those that we're sort of talking and joking about now. He's telling anyone that discovers his music that the way that they listen to music is okay. Don't listen to what the major labels tell you. File sharing isn't killing music. And you have to remember, you know, in 2006, the label executives are holding their empire like sand between their knuckles. And here's MC Lars touring college campuses across the country with his Dell laptop, telling students to steal his music and buy the merch. And, you know, I understand, you know, JJ, you didn't manage MC Lars until much, much later in his career. But I wonder if you have some stories to share about his early days and sort of advocating for the iGeneration and downloading music at a time when these are very serious, critical conversations in the larger music industry.
Well, I didn't manage Lars back in 2006, but I was his booking agent back in 2006. He and I have been friends for, you know, since then, and he's one of my best friends. And at the time, I remember I heard that record. I was working as an intern at the agency group, and I had picked a CD off the shelf, and I was listening to it. And when I heard Download This Song, it was like the most punk rock thing I had ever heard. I had just graduated college and I studied digital music licensing, and I was, you know, had a huge chip on my shoulder when it came to digital rights and what was going on with piracy. So when I heard that record, I was like, this is amazing, you know. And what's funny is, looking back on that now, it's almost crass, like the things that he's introducing that even I perceived as being like really crazy. I can't believe he's saying this in this song. He's got, like he says, music was a product, now it is a service. Major record labels, why are you trying to hurt us? And it was like, yeah, man, wow, like music could be a service. That's crazy.
Now, and I think that's like Spotify's marketing tag.
Totally. I mean, but that's the funny part is like, so this year we did Warped Tour, and we were playing the Spotify stage. And so now here I am, you know, so I'm quite some time in the future, and I'm Lars's manager now. And we're playing, you know, he's playing that song on the Spotify stage, and he's singing all these lyrics that seem like really dated and almost like just kind of a statement of fact rather than it like these outrageous claims. And I mean, the best part is there's a part in that bridge where he's got like this kind of spoken word part in the bridge where he says, you know, you've been overcharging us for music for years, and we just want a level playing field. I hate to say it, but welcome to the future. And when he plays that song live, you know, every day to that tour, he's like, welcome to the present. And a bunch of kids that are too young to remember are just like, what is he talking about? This isn't as cool as the Mr. Raven or whatever. But it was, even just being there for those shows was kind of a moment for me, is realizing like these radical ideas that brought us together and made me really want to meet him, and ultimately, you know, is responsible for our friendship, they happened, and it seems like a long time, but it's really, I mean, that was 2006. So, I mean, it's longer than probably it should have, but, the world changes eventually.
For sure. I mean, you know, 2006, I would be a senior in high school. So, for sure, interesting time, because I would have actually downloaded that song off the internet probably, or, you know, saw it on YouTube or whatever. What's interesting too, I mean, what you're saying about that bridge there, you know, 2006, when MC Lars is saying about how, you know, the major labels are overcharging for music, that wasn't just figuratively true, it was like literally true. There was a class action lawsuit where the major labels got banged for overcharging fans for music, and there was like a huge settlement there. I can't remember if that came out just slightly after, if he was actually citing things from right then.
I don't know, man. That's a good question. I don't know the answer to that. I mean, I think either scenario works. It's either just like a statement of opinion, or if it is referencing that. I think that I feel like, you know, I felt the same way. I felt like here you had this. I think really when I had a CD burner for the first time, I'd have been like 16, well, maybe younger, 15, 16, when I had a CD burner. And at that moment, it was like, okay, well, this should be cheaper, right? I mean, before, like, I don't need the CD anymore. And I think when iTunes came out and kind of in the dust of Napster, it was like, I remember being like, what? Like, why are these $10? Like, I mean, it's not the same thing. I think there was a lot of those little tiny little incremental like things that went off in my mind, and probably in the mind of all kinds of nerds. They're like, well, this isn't fair. Somehow this isn't fair, you know?
For sure. What I'd love to hear your thoughts on, I mean, we're really sort of talking about this idea about, you know, forward-thinking artists who understand their audience. And if you look, I mean, of the sort of music industry conversation for the last several years, every once in a while, it will be John Mellencamp or another artist going into the headlines and saying, hey, so-and-so isn't paying us, this isn't working. So-and-so isn't paying us, this isn't working. And it's interesting because, like, you know, when you're working for MC Lars, you're booking his tours, you're later managing him, he's rapping about music as a service and getting paid for being seen on the road. So you don't necessarily have this sort of cognitive dissonance between how your artist views their creativity and how they ought to monetize it with how their audience views their, you know, music as a sort of product or service or free commodity through the internet that was marginalized by rapid abundance. So I'd really love to hear, like, in your career as a manager, have you ever gotten to sort of talk to other managers and they're kind of like, man, you've got it so easy, JJ. Like, your artists get what's happening right now. They're rapping about it. My artists, they want to make money. And they love their fans, but not that much. So, like, is there a dissonance between the fact that you've been lucky to work with very forward-thinking artists and other managers may have had to sort of have these, like, oh, guys, like, this is just how it is now, and this just isn't available, and the artist being upset about that. Like, how do you feel about that sort of dissonance?
Well, I haven't really experienced that, to be honest. I mean, I think it'd be really, for the most part, you know, most of the people that are also managers that I interact with are friends of mine, and so if things are going well, usually they're pretty supportive and cool about it. And if it's not that, then usually they're not really sure how I'm making a living, you know, like, and to be completely honest, a lot of the times, like, I haven't been either. I mean, my career as a manager has been very, like, even though I deliberately, you know, I was 16 years old, I decided I wanted to be an artist manager, and that's what I was going to do, which is weird because I didn't really know much about what an artist manager did. I'm not sure why that was the thing, but, like, my career, for the most part, has been, it's just kind of like, I find these bands I like, we become friends, and I do my best to help run that business. And it's been a lot of trial by fire, and I'm learning it as I go. So it's, I don't know, in a weird way, I feel like if there's ever, there's never really any jealousy, I think, on the part of my contemporaries. Most of the time, I think they probably imagine that I'm either, like, tearing my hair out or I'm doing some other weird voodoo that they don't really understand. And especially as my career as a manager developed, so much more of my focus became really more a broader business focus rather than a specifically music industry focus, because a band like Hi-Fi Dragons or Lars or, you know, Big D and the Kids Table, Mad Caddies, these bands that I had that were, like, so far out of, like, you know, the view of anyone in the industry, that, like, we had to figure out a way to make money. And there are a lot of ways to make money. I mean, the music business certainly isn't easy, but it's not dissimilar to other businesses in that you understand your brand, you understand your products, and you understand your customers. And if you know that the kids might like, maybe they're going to like a dog tag that also is a USB drive or whatever, which Hi-Fi Dragons did, although that was Brian's idea. But, like, if they're going to like it, we're going to make it. And now you have another, you know, revenue stream. So I guess I've never really had any friction from artists the way that maybe other managers have. But I've also kind of, like, really came by it honestly. Like, I'm pretty good friends with everyone I've worked with as a band. So it's like, you know, that I typically don't know anything they don't know, and vice versa.
How do you feel that, you know, your career as a manager running the small businesses of these artists and, you know, gleaning that entrepreneurial spirit of really trying to understand what your band makes, what your audience wants, and the sort of collective compromise of those things, how did that prepare you to work in the larger music business, or even sort of life in general? Because I'm sure there's lots of really important, interesting lessons there.
Oh, absolutely, man. I feel like for me personally, you know, Courtney said a little bit at the beginning, but, like, I'm at a point in my life where I'm interested in, you know, doing all different kinds of work. And I feel like I had this kind of experience as a manager, which is something I love dearly, and I love music very dearly. But over the time, you develop skills that are really applicable to all different kinds of, you know, project management or entrepreneurial endeavors, where, like, a lot of it is philosophy and problem solving and being able, you know, to work with a team of people. In a weird way, that's been a tremendous benefit of managing these bands that were weird. Even Flowbots was really, you know, that might have been a huge record, but like it's not that often that like a 6-piece viola rap band from Colorado makes, you know, like it has any kind of success. So every single step of the way has been like, okay, almost I'm able to have like Zen mind, child's mind about it. It's the first time. There's not a lot of precedent to follow. And so that's helped me a lot, both personally and professionally.
So the other thing that I'm really interested in hearing about is DIY marketing. Because I know when you're a manager of an artist, there's this process of constant give and take between the promotional strategies that you imagine and the ones that they're sort of willing to help execute. Because if you've had, you know, sort of moderate success with an artist, you have companies coming to the table that would like to attach their music to certain brands. You have different apps or websites that would like to have the band promote their product. And there's just this negotiation that I imagine takes place about what they're willing to partake in, what sort of aligns with their brand, and the sort of stuff that they're just like, look, JJ, we're not going to go on the coconut juice commercial no matter what you tell us. So I just love to hear, like, with either MC Lars or Flowbots or any of the other artists that you've worked with, how does the process of negotiation work out when you have a sort of partner at the table and the band either likes them or hates them?
Yeah, I mean, I think that that's a really common obstacle that I think a lot of people in music deal with. Even if you're a product manager at a label and you're interacting with a manager who the manager gets to play the role of the fussy guy that doesn't want to do anything on behalf of the artist, that happens all the time. And I think reconciling that experience is, if you can learn how to do that, that is the job. And I think that's almost 90% of the job for a marketer is, you know, being able to kind of help explain possibilities to the people that you're working for, and being willing to let them, you know, let them fall through. I think that's a lesson you learn. Like, if I really want to do something and I recommend it to an artist and they don't want to do it, usually disaster ensues if I'm super attached to that idea and I'm not willing to hear them. As a manager, for me, I guess it's been a little bit easier, certainly than it was during my time at a label, where, you know, I mean, for the most part, trust is everything with management and also with production. A lot of these skills have really helped me as a producer too. You know, we're on the same team for the most part when I'm managing bands, so I kind of know what the brand is, and we've earned each other's trust where, like, you know, if they'll hear me out and I'll have to hear them out. And negotiating those things is how an organization works, whether it be a band or a small company or a lot of different people. So I think that's, you know, it certainly varies artist to artist. Flowbots didn't like doing a lot of promotional stuff because they were very concerned about the message and the meaning behind the things they were doing. Not a lot of people know this, but they were, you know, they were building a nonprofit organization throughout all of that to try to, you know, advocate for some change in the world. And they've done a great job. The organization's still around. So they were super cautious about what things that they were aligning themselves with. And we said no a lot. Whereas, you know, someone like Hi-Fi Dragons, you know, Brian is a great dude, extremely brilliant person, and very much on the same page as me when it comes to experimenting with new things and trying different ways of marketing stuff. So it's going to vary artist to artist and brand to brand. But being able to have those conversations is a crucial skill, especially in dealing with artists. And I think that, you know, anybody who's been in this business for a while will hopefully be getting better at that. Like, the better you get at that, the easier your job is.
Cool. So I wanted to sort of take the conversation a little bit of a different direction. This is a little bit more connected to the stuff that I was talking about earlier, but I wanted to ask, you know, why album release plans are based on fundamentally the same template that they were in the 90s. And so I've been following this Arcade Fire sort of viral marketing cycle that seems to have been going on for like a year now. And yeah, it's like they're doing some clever stuff. I mean, they've had some interesting graffiti in my neighborhood, and, you know, I get all excited and I think it's Banksy, and then it's like, oh, it's just Arcade Fire promotion. But it's not like that fundamentally different from the rollout of, say, like a Pearl Jam record in 1995. And you release content. I mean, the content now is a little cooler, but it's still content and singles, because everyone releases their singles. And then there's like a magic chosen Tuesday, like that the gods of record labels have decreed as the day, and the album appears, and then you go on tour. And interactive puzzles are way more fun than a big budget music video, but they're pretty much the same thing. So, like, again, why hasn't, after everything that's happened, why is the album release cycle essentially kind of the same thing?
I mean, it's a lot of ways kind of the same, I think, is what we were talking about before with chart positions and first week. And there's these habits that people develop, and that not just limited to the labels and the managers, but also the retailers and the magazines and the radio stations and the TV shows. Like, there's just kind of been this system, and it's kind of just the way that it is. So people are, for the most part, creatures of habit. I think it's relatively benign for the most part, because I guess it's cool that people are doing anything to be marketing anything. And the only time that becomes a problem is when it stops. I think that that's a major error in judgment for most marketers, that, you know, okay, well, now it's out, so we're done. And I think the way that people interact with media now is so much so that if you do get an engagement with someone, if someone does see a cool piece of graffiti on the wall, it'd be great if they can go straight to their computer and interact with what you're trying to get them to interact with, rather than, I don't know, put it in their calendar that this thing is coming or whatever, you know. So in terms of direct marketing, I think it could certainly be done better, and if it was done while there was product actually out. But to appease, I think the other things that a lot of the time people are trying to do with the rollout, you know, those are just kind of the rules that they play by, because that's kind of what everyone is doing, and it's kind of, it'd be great. I'm sure it'll change eventually, but for the moment, like, that's just still, they do it, whatever. And again, for me, it's very, very rare that I'm working with something that is like that in that system, you know. Even at a label, to me, that was never really the way I'd like to think of it. Like, I'd much prefer, like, instead of it being like a rollout, being like a roll on, like, we're going to keep doing this no matter what. Like, we have a product, we think people are going to like it, let's keep doing things to market it to more people, and hopefully over a long period of time, you know. But
yeah, I mean, I guess the other sort of thing with a lot of the new, quote unquote, new marketing, although, I mean, this has been happening for a while now, is this idea of like the sort of virality and this, you know, it's like with Miley Cyrus and everything that's happened. It's like, I remember when Madonna put out her sex book in the 90s and everyone freaked out about that. And then Britney Spears put on a schoolgirl outfit and everyone freaked out about that. And now Miley Cyrus is twerking and everyone's freaking out about that. And what's interesting to me is, like, it's just marketing. And I feel like people just get so up in arms, and I'm like, no, this is just because they want to sell more records. Like, Miley Cyrus is a 20-year-old adult woman who grew up in the music industry. Like, she knows how this works. And she's, like, my dream guest for this podcast, because she probably knows more about the music industry than, like, any of us. And I just, like, I don't understand why people kind of can't critically look at it and be like, oh, yeah, this is not some grand social statement that this half-naked girl is making. This is because she wants to monetize her song.
Yeah, I mean, I love South Park. I'm a huge South Park fan. Like, there's an episode of South Park where the boys are trying to save Britney Spears, who's like on this horrible suicidal rage. And slowly but surely they discover that the, like, systematic building up and tearing down of women in of celebrity is, like, dates back to ancient tribal virgin sacrifice. And that it's just this anthropological principle that's happening. It's stuck in my mind ever since, as many South Park episodes do. But I mean, that concept, I think, is a lot larger than music. I think it's just, there's, for whatever reason, man, like, it's a thing. And I think especially when you're on the outside looking in, you're like, well, like, you know, no way. Like, what the heck? How are all these people falling for it? But there's a lot of people that are super, super, super ingrained and interested in what's going on in celebrity. And there's like kind of a massive social psychology around celebrity that is really, really fascinating and confusing. At the same time, it's kind of like people are into weird stuff, man. Like, I love comic books and pro wrestling, like, way more than an adult should. So, you know, I can't. If people like the Kardashians and Miley Cyrus and stuff, it's very hard for me to judge if I look at myself in the mirror. But I think with Miley, it's like it's hard to think of that as like the music business as much as it is the celebrity business. And music is just kind of one of the monetization strategies of that celebrity business. So, like, you know, the Kardashians have a TV show and they have a shoe club of the month or whatever. And Miley has, you know, YouTube income and iTunes revenue and whatever else. But I think that, I mean, the draw is deeper than music, and I think people's interaction to music. So it's very, very hard to compare, like, what artists I work with do to what she's doing. It's like totally completely different thing.
So I'd like to now kind of shift the conversation another direction, and it's really pertinent to what we've been talking about, which is that, you know, early in the conversation, we talked about how MC Lars was identifying with this time in the music industry that has since passed. Like, he's on the Spotify stage talking about music as a service and concerts as an experience, and everyone in the audience, like, forgets that that was a radical idea in 2006. I'd like to expand on that topic of some of those theories that were around during that time. So, you know, like, when you were an artist manager, you had Chris Anderson's Long Tail, Hypebot's Rise of the Musical Middle Class, and then even a little bit later, Kevin Kelly's post on how 1,000 true fans can support an artist. And I'm sure there's many more that I'm forgetting, Music Like Water and et cetera, right? So I'd really like to hear about, you know, when you're managing an artist in the trenches, so to speak, and you're making big decisions, little decisions that will potentially impact your careers, and you're hearing all of these sort of big theories from the tech elite, did you ever look to these thinkers for guidance on how you should sort of grow and sort of monetize their businesses, or were you just a little bit skeptical about how the long tail, what exactly that means anything to you?
Well, I'm not afraid to admit that I was like foolishly skeptical of a lot of those ideas when they were happening, I think, at first. Because I was young, and I just spent 4 years in college learning how everything worked, and a couple of years afterwards only to find out that, you know, well, it's different. So there was a kind of a long period, not well, maybe not long. There was a period there where I had to grow, and I had to let go of my attachment to what I thought was the way things are. I want to say I made that transition probably early by comparison to other folks, but if I remember that time, a lot of people talked about those things a lot more than they tried to put them in practice. And I think in a lot of ways they still do. I think it's an especially bad habit that that people in music have is to acknowledge these new ideas and talk about them as if they're implementing them and then do the exact same thing they're always doing. And I was probably guilty of that too. Inevitably, I kind of like... You know, I opened up to those ideas, and I think I'm more influenced by the philosophies of business, particularly in tech, but in general. And that's like thinking of things from the kind of that philosophical standpoint has helped guide a lot of the decisions that I've made. And so, again, a cool thing about doing it the way that I've done it is I've been exposed to a lot of those ideas, and now there's a lot of them kicking around in there to kind of grab at any given moment.
Yeah, I mean, you're definitely a very philosophical sort of worldly person, and yet you have this like background of this entrepreneurial spirit. And I'd be curious about how you went about bridging the gap between the philosophy of something like The Long Tail or 1,000 True Fans or, hey guys, you gotta make it into the musical middle class, into, you know, actionable, tangible steps that the band could get behind and want to sort of forge a path forward with you as their manager?
Yeah, I think you look to those, at least for me, I mean, if I was to really examine my relationship with those ideas are, you know, it's like any theory. It's like the theory stands on its own, but at least in terms, the, you know, execution is a huge part of the success of a theory. And, you know, more than anything, more than it was a plotted out specific tasks or things that I felt like we could do to achieve this theoretical goal, is more like kind of absorbing that, those thoughts, trying to share those thoughts with the people that I'm working with, the bands. And then, you know, in a weird way, that gave us more hope than it was, you know, that our experimentation was worthwhile, than it was like, oh, we've got to get to 1,000 true fans. You know, that's a pretty arbitrary number. And I think that like, certainly for me, man, when the first time someone introduced that idea, I was like, that ain't going to work. That doesn't work for music. There's too many people attached to it. And then as I learned more about what 1,000 true fans was about and realized like it's 1,000 true fans per person that's being supported by the organization of the project, then it was like, okay, well, yeah, that's doable, but we're talking about 10,000 people that are willing to spend $100 a year on your band. That's a really lofty goal. So if we ever, I hope we can achieve that. That's a great goal to set. You know, I think for the most part, more than it is about deliberately trying to copy those ideas, it was like absorbing them and trying to create a culture of the people that I'm working with where we're aware of these ideas as possibilities, and they give us a lot more hope in the things that we were doing.
It seems like the reason why, you know, the music industry is so receptive to these theories at that time is that, you know, we were all still sort of out in the wild trying to figure this all out. It felt like anyone's game to win or lose. No one really had all the answers. So when these, you know, sort of pundits came along and, you know, brought forth these ideas, it's like, yeah, 10,000 hours of practice, yeah, you know, direct-to-fan marketing, yeah, you know, music discovery. Like, all of these sort of really sort of philosophical frameworks had really vested interests of some kind, sure, but they also had a lot of hope behind them. It's that, like, we were always looking to the horizon that another sort of silver bullet of some kind might come along and sort of save us, so to speak. And, you know, I think that, you know, we're definitely still in the wild to some extent, but a lot of these, you know, visions for the future have actually sort of found their way to the present. We have all of these subscription music services now officially licensed and launched in the U.S. You have this new age of curation and playlist services emerging, you know, as well as many more sort of apps and services that are trying to recommend and present music in different ways. And I guess, you know, where I'm sort of taking this is, like, where do you feel like, you know, you fell on this spectrum in sort of different stages in your career, where it's like, were you making the rules? Were you breaking the rules? Were you following them? Like, at what point did you maybe feel sort of lost in the wild, or like, where you were truly making new ground, or at other times were you like combining the best of what was available and making new paths?
I mean, I think to be honest, like the biggest mistakes I ever made, and I think one of the biggest, like the easiest ways to make a huge mistake is to be trying to follow someone else's thoughts or ideas as if that's like a rule or that's the thing, or to try to be the next that thing, or try to take, you know, a broader conceptual, you know, this idea and try to make that your reality verbatim as if it's like kind of paint by numbers. Like, I certainly feel like that never helped me. It never helped me to try to be like, oh, well, 1,000 true fans, let's go get 1,000 true fans. And I think the one thing that, for me, and I think I talk about this a lot, is that every project is different. Every band is different. Everything is different. When you are in this weird, chaotic spectrum of whatever's happening in music, all you can rely on is your presence of mind to be able to make rational decisions in the moment, and to encourage your other people around you to do that too. So a big part of artist management is helping, your artists and the people around you to be focused in the present moment and to understand what's actually happening, and to that our choices are made based on our needs and who we are and not necessarily based on some other philosophy. Now, that said, like, I love hearing those ideas and I love talking about them. But I think you said it well, like, everyone's kind of looking for this that silver bullet. Everyone was thinking that, like, one of these ideas is going to be the thing that fixed everything. And I think we're far enough down this road now to realize that, you know, there is no one silver bullet. It's like all of these little things contribute, and it, you know, if you it's thoughts, like, these thoughts kind of collect to make new thoughts. And hopefully, if you're thinking for yourself, you can make good decisions. It's really, really hard to kind of put any band or any project into, like, this is the archetype for how we do this, you know?
So, I mean, last night I actually had the pleasure of seeing Malcolm Gladwell speak about his new book, David and Goliath. And once things got into the QA session, you know, some people were asking about, you know, his writing routine, how he came up with these ideas, how hard did he work, what was his upbringing like, what was the conversation that happened at Malcolm Gladwell's table. And, you know, as we're sort of saying, like, we as humans are really susceptible to this idea that if I can just, you know, get insight into how JJ is productive, get insight into how you get your ideas, or insight into how, you know, Courtney writes her copy, that we'll be able to succeed in the way that other people are successful, or that we'll get insights about their creativity that will sort of give feel into our own. And it really does feel like, you know, the music industry has a really long history of saying, you know, well, you know, Radiohead, they did this great promotion about, you know, name your own price, we should do that now. Amanda Palmer had this great thing with the Kickstarter, we should try that now. Why are we so susceptible about trying to replicate past successes, and how do we move forward and set new standards?
I mean, I think that's a much broader, psychological and philosophical question probably than I'm qualified to answer, but I will answer it. I'll pretend like I know the answer to this. Like, I mean, I think that we're as people in general, I think if you grow up in you know, Western society, and you're kind of, you're rewarded for following the rules. I mean, there's, like, public school is, there's indoctrination to, there's a way to do this, there's a right way and a wrong way, and you do it. And I think not even just limited to music, but in general, the world is a much different place than the way it was when, like, the Horace Mann education system was developed, and when there was there's one way to do things. And I think the music industry probably isn't much different from many other industries, in that you see something working, go, oh, well, that's the new thing to do it. You just do it like they did. But I think the weird part about that is, I think the music industry, because we've been where we are for longer, we've been confronting the obstacles of media online for longer, I think that we need to be more innovative, and we need to be going, you know, where the puck is going, not where the puck is, more than other industries. And I think across the board, when you see people that are successful, or when Amanda Palmer does what Amanda Palmer did, she did it because she was trying to be the first Amanda Palmer, not, you know, the next Amanda Palmer. And I mean, it's a habit that everybody has. I think it's a bad habit across the board. If you can't go wrong when you be yourself, and or be your band. You know, play to the strengths of what you've got and make the best decisions for you. And that's kind of how you end up being that guy that everybody's trying to copy the big idea, you know. A lot of the time, it's not your idea. With I Fight Dragons, I had a couple of those moments where everyone was like, wow, look at these genius moments. And all I did that was genius was, like, agree with the band. Be like, yeah, that's a good idea. There we go.
So I wanted to ask you a little bit about the Gautier record, because I know that you were involved with that. And I know that there were a lot of, like, weird sort of near misses, and it seems like the label really didn't handle that record like it should. I mean, the single was huge, but the single has come and gone, and I haven't heard anything since. So now the album has sort of faded, and it's sort of this, like, quirky one-hit wonder rather than, you know, an artist's established body of work. And I was just sort of wondering, you know, what you thought of that whole process and how you were involved with it.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'd say, first of all, I think I'm not sure that the label would see that as a bad. I don't know that they'd look at the Gautier rollout as being unsuccessful. I'm super biased and super subjective on this one because I was working at Republic at the time. I was a product manager for that record early on, right as it came in, and as it was kind of building momentum. And that was that single and that video was kind of, it was pretty obvious that that was, you know, that was growing at a very, very fast rate, and that was going to be a big hit. I think it was as close to obvious as, you know, you can get in the guessing hits business. And I mean, for me, I had experience. I think the one hit wonder phenomenon is like purely psychological. I think that this is, you know, this is my opinion, but I think that, you know, if one song is absolutely everywhere, it stands to reason that you'll lose interest in learning more about it, about that artist, about that song. And you have a tendency to feel like you know it completely, you know the artist completely, even though you've only heard the one song. It's everywhere. It's no longer something that's worth researching or experiencing more of. You know it. Oh, I know that song. I know Gautier. That song is everywhere. And I think that it also, you know, when something's that ubiquitous, it creates this expectation that the other songs in the record have to be as good as that song, or this is a one-hit wonder. This is a thing. Like it's bad if the other songs on the record aren't as good as a single. And I think if you don't have a ubiquitous single that's all over the place, that's not really a standard that we apply to things, you know? Like, we expect the single to be the best song. That's why it's a single. So I had experienced that firsthand with Flobots, in a way that was really, really still kind of stung. And I didn't want to do that again. So when I'm holding the reins with Gautier and working at Universal, you know, it was I don't have a lot of experience working at a label. I'd ended up in this job through this really crazy kind of series of events, but I was really happy to do it, and I was really happy to be working on something and try to kind of prevent that from happening. That to me, that was let it sit. It was growing so fast, and so many people were getting interested in Gautier. The video was great, the song was great, and people listened to the record, and there was this interest there. And I felt like if we went to Top 40 Radio right away and just like did all the things that label was absolutely great at doing, that we'd really hurt our chances of be able to go much further than that single. Again, totally theory. And then inevitably what happened is I was let go from Universal like pretty abruptly. And I'm not really sure what happened to the label after that, to be honest. I'm not sure what took place. We can see that single was massive, and the record kind of, you know, doesn't get a lot of attention. That said, it's hard for me to say that the label made a mistake, because I wasn't there to see really what was going on. Anything's possible. There's just a lot of things I don't know. But I would say, I mean, honestly, I do think the Gautier record is better than it's given credit for. I think he's a tremendous artist. And I mean, if there is any injustice there, it's that a lot of people probably that would really like that record didn't check it out.
Well, what's interesting about that, and I'm glad you sort of mentioned what happened with, you know, holding back from Top 40, because I think Universal might have almost learned their lesson, because I was talking to someone over there, and with the new Lord record, or Lorda, or however you pronounce it, you know, the Royals song, they were holding that back from Top 40 for a long time. Like, they really wanted to, you know, have that grow much more slowly than it actually did. And, you know, now they've gone full on, and every time I go to the grocery store, I hear that song. It's really creepy, like, every single time. But yeah, I feel like they've definitely sort of learned their lesson. But I do see, like, she might have a similar fate, because the rest of her record is good, as the rest of the Gautier record was good, but that one song is, like, massive among other good songs.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of things you can do to avoid that, and so much, I have to say, like, the I never had the chance to really take the reins further than I did with Gotye. I was disappointed that it was the way that it was, because I felt like I really wanted to, you know, to slay that dragon. But I think it comes.
You wanted to fight that dragon.
I wanted to fight that dragon, right? The outcome is unknown. Well, you can kind of see it, man. There's one label that is probably the best promotions label in the business, and this kind of thing tends to happen every now and then. And it, you know, whether it be, you know, Flobots or Owl City or Chumbawamba or Lord or Gotye or any of them, there's a lot of those. But that said, there are great people at the label. I'm a guy with a couple ideas. I honestly don't really know how avoidable that is or isn't in practice, but I sure think that there are better ways to do it. I think, for example, the Gotye record came out the same time the Fun record came out, and I love Fun. I love the format, and I thought that they did a spectacular job on that, on letting that first single kind of drown out when it did and add a second single. I don't think they could have gone with, you know, the biggest hits on that record without opening with the first single. And I thought that was just a very deliberate action. They did a really great job.
Yeah. You know, kind of going back to the question above, I mean, does an artist like, and I mean, Gotye is sort of a strange case because the rest of the record didn't sound as much like the single, but I'm sort of wondering if Gotye should have even made a record, or should he just be making songs? To go back to what we talked about earlier, like, is he the guy who puts out a new EP every 4 months and one of those songs on the EP is a single?
I think specifically speaking for Gotye, I don't know that he would have made, I think that record, he put a lot of heart into that record, and that record I think was a complete statement he wanted to make. I'm not sure that, I don't know, but I think that in a weird way, this single and the full-length album were almost mutually inclusive in that environment. I'm not sure that he'd have done one without the other. But that's all speculation. I think people can absolutely put out one single, especially if that's going to be your song, and just do it. I mean, there's nothing preventing them from doing that. But sometimes that's the process too, though. Sometimes the process of being able to get to that one song is making a bunch of other songs around it.
Yeah. I guess, like, that's sort of my last question is, you know, if that's the new process and if we're expecting artists to be more single-driven and put out more singles, I mean, I look at an artist like Rihanna, who never seems to be off. Like, she puts out a record every year. Like, it's November. There's a Rihanna album coming out. You just know. It's like hurricanes on the East Coast. And, you know, and she's touring all the time, and she never seems to have any downtime where she can, like, percolate. And because she's not an artist who really writes many of her own songs, she doesn't have to. But for an artist like Gotye, you know, that's kind of a weird new normal when you can't have any time off to, like, hang out and percolate and think and walk in the woods. Like, you're constantly expected to be pushing out content all the time. So even from, like, an artist's, like, labor perspective, I mean, how do you think if it moves in the direction of, like, just be putting out singles every 3 months, like, how do you think that's going to affect artists and their creative work?
I mean, I think that's a really good question. I mean, I think it's for the most part, it's all in how you define work, man. I think it's kind of arguable whether or not this was ever, like, something that people took time off of. The creative process sometimes needs that. I mean, I've learned a lot, I feel like, this year working in production and kind of being this weird, as a producer, you're kind of like the midwife for the music baby. And the more time you give that process, the better. So I think a lot of the times people almost have to deliberately give themselves a place of peace where they can be thinking about what they're making next. In a lot of ways, that's work. You know, it's a thing that you're doing specifically for an outcome. But I think more so than even the release schedule, I think to market yourself well in the future, and especially in the age of streaming and revenue now being generated based on how often someone interacts with what you made rather than the one-time purchase, like, the marketing demands are going to be higher. And I think most people probably won't be taking much time off at all anymore. I think it's all kind of in the way that a lot of us are, where work and life are kind of this weird meshed kind of like a thing. It's the same thing.
Yeah.
I think that's incredibly insightful, JJ. Dude, it's been really great having you on the podcast and hearing your thoughts on management, midwifing albums, MC Lars, the history of music industry theory. If people want to look you up online and hear more about what you have to say, where can they find you?
I don't know, man. Follow me on Twitter. I'm at JJ Italiano. That's where I say most of the things I shouldn't say.
I understand awesome. You used to have a blog where you did that too, right? What was that called?
I did. I had a blog called WeAllFucked.com, and I took it down once I started working at a place where a lot of the people I talked about in the blog were my coworkers out of fear. But you know, there's that.
Very cool, JJ.
Maybe someday soon. If I continue to be gainfully unemployed for much longer, then everyone's on blast. I'll buy a bunch of offensive URLs and say all kinds of things that I'm not an expert about.
Awesome. You're the next Bob Lefsetz.
Yeah, I could be the next Bob Lefsetz. Oh, snap. I was trying not to put anyone on blast, but it looks like we Bob Lefsetz.
Italiano letters. I hear Berlin letters is already reserved in my name.
Oh, good, man. Oh, I would love it. I'd read it.
Well, that's all for this episode of The Upward Spiral. Thank you to Hypebot.com for putting this out. If you have any questions or comments, please, please email us at upwardspiralpodcast@gmail.com. And be sure to follow us on Twitter at upwardspiralpod. Don't forget to subscribe in iTunes. If you like the show, please rate us highly. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Have a great day.